of society, of culture, of foreign policy, the attitude, implicit and sometimes explicit, from corporate media is, well, that's okay, because we get along with this system just fine. And of course, a lot of the corporate funding is overlapping between members of Congress who get contributions from Pentagon contractors, interlocking boards of directors from weapons suppliers, arms makers who are selling so much to the Pentagon, and those who sit on the boards of U.S. media outlets. And so it's a very comfortable relationship. And when anti-war forces and organizers try to disrupt that relationship, we're really not welcome to have a seat at the table to even be part of the discourse.
You're listening to Norman Solomon, War Crimes and War Criminals. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Why is there no discussion of U.S. war crimes and war criminals? Why aren't high officials held accountable?
The attitude from corporate media in the United States, from Congress, from the White House, has traditionally been and continues to be that the U.S. can take the stance to the world, do as we say, not as we do. So the USA is good at pointing the fingers at Russia, at other countries that invade a different nation. But when the U.S. does it, it's a whole other thing. As was said long ago by the great journalist I.F. Stone, all governments lie and nothing they say should be believed. That's not to say that governments always lie, but we should always have a high degree of skepticism when we're told certain narratives by governments and the stenographic journalists who love to present those pronouncements from government as fact. And if you read the op-ed pages and the editorial sections of the New York Times and Washington Post and other outlets of the so-called liberal media, the doublethink is well in place that Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. Well, I happen to think he is a war criminal. I also happen to think that George W. Bush is a war criminal. And we could go on to many other examples of high U.S. government officials where absolutely that description applies equally as compared to the case of Vladimir Putin. Well, can you find a single major newspaper willing to editorialize, for instance, that George W. Bush, having based on lies, ordered the invasion of Iraq, costing hundreds of thousands of lives? Can you find any instance where a major U.S. media outlet refers to George W. Bush as a war criminal? It just ain't going to happen. You're not going to find it. And one of the aspects that I was happy to explore in the book, in a grim sort of way, is the rehabilitation of this war criminal, George W. Bush, which is a paradigm for the presidents who followed, because if there's that sort of psychological impunity, if you will, towards that president who committed those war crimes, then it lets the subsequent presidents off the hook. Ellen DeGeneres made a big deal on her TV show about going to a ball game with George W. Bush. And she said, I don't agree with him on some things, but I'm his friend and I'm very glad to be his friend. Then Michelle Obama, while her husband was in the White House, she also made a big show out of how she's friends with George W. Bush and displayed their friendship publicly and said, well, we disagree on some policies, but we share the same values. In a way, that's an unintended metaphor for the policies. Whether it's George W. Bush or Barack Obama, they too shared the same values. They differed on some policies. But maintained the prerogative, not just theoretically, but in action, to order the continuation of, or in Bush's case, initiation of an invasion and occupation that took vast numbers of lives. I quote President Obama speaking to troops in Afghanistan. And you could take one sentence after another of his speeches there and find almost identical sentences with Lyndon Johnson speaking in 1966 to the troops in Vietnam. They both talked about how the U.S. soldiers were compassionate, cared about human life, and were trying to help the suffering people of Vietnam or Afghanistan. And this is the pernicious theme that we also get quite often with almost any U.S. war, that with the best of intentions, the U.S. is seeking to help those of other countries. And it's a way of making the victims at the other end of U.S. firepower invisible. There are two tiers of grief in U.S. mass media and in U.S. politics, from Congress to the White House. Our grief and their grief. Our grief is Americans, or those who are sort of designated as honorary semi-Americans, so to speak, as people in Ukraine, those who are killed by official enemy governments of the United States. That's the real tier of grief, we are implicitly told. And so when the U.S. media covered, as it should, has covered the suffering of people in Ukraine because of the war of aggression by Russia, those people in U.S. media are real. Their suffering is made as real as can be in the media. And yet, when it's the U.S. that has been slaughtering people in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and elsewhere, that's another tier of grief. The people who were at the other end of U.S. weapons, the civilians, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them directly killed, into the millions indirectly killed by U.S. warfare, their tier of grief is not on the media map. It's implicit through the lack of coverage and the tone of coverage, with rare exceptions, that they as human beings just don't matter.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the average American consumer of news knows scant little about what its country is doing internationally. How to rectify that?
When I talked with Daniel Ellsberg, he made the point that it's perhaps somewhat to the credit of the people of the United States that they're lied to so routinely about war, because in a sense, these are my words, people can plead ignorance, which is a pretty accurate plea for the most part. And we can attribute it to the news media and the government leaders that they serve so ably. So it raises the question, how much do people really know? How much do people really want to know? And I think, especially culturally, people in general perhaps don't really want to know information that's unpleasant. There are studies that say when people hear opinions they don't like, they're much more inclined to turn the channel on television. And I believe it's a mixture, that people often don't want to hear what's unpleasant, but also I don't think that should let the news media off the hook, because if we had media outlets with integrity, with a single standard of human rights, really practicing, not just in theory, but in practice, journalism without fear or favor, we would really change the politics of this country. If hypothetically you or I, David, could edit the New York Times for a few weeks, there would be huge ripple effects in the society, because information would flow not through fear or favor in reality, but journalism as practiced as journalism should be would mean people would hear what they didn't want to hear. And if so-called journalism is just telling people more or less what they do want to hear and reinforcing it, that's advertising. That's not journalism.
one of the, I would say, benefits for countries that commit war crimes that are hooked up to the U.S. empire is that they are all given free passes when it comes to human rights violations, violations of the U.N. Charter and international law. I'm just thinking off the top of my head, Turkey, India, Israel, and there are many others who commit crimes but are given a free pass.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, when President Biden went to Saudi Arabia and did a fist bump with the de facto ruler of that country, there was only a muted criticism. And yet, here we have a country, Saudi Arabia, a U.S. ally, that has been slaughtering people in Yemen for many years. And it's very notable that at the end of 2017, at that point, almost 3 years of war had gone on with the U.S.-led or the Saudi-led U.S.-supported bombing of Yemen. FAIR at the Media Watch Group did this in-depth study, and they looked at the coverage of that humanitarian crisis in Yemen, which was second to none in the world at that point, and found that MSNBC had done virtually no coverage. I'm quoting here. An analysis by FAIR has found that the leading liberal cable network did not run a single segment devoted specifically to Yemen in the last half of 2017. Moreover, in all of 2017, MSNBC only aired one broadcast on the U.S.-backed Saudi airstrikes that have killed thousands of Yemeni civilians, and it never mentioned the impoverished nation's colossal cholera epidemic, which inflicted more than 1 million Yemenis in the largest outbreak in recorded history, unquote. So here you have the, we're told, liberal network, MSNBC, virtually ignoring the slaughter of people backed by the United States, led by Saudi Arabia in Yemen, despite the fact, I think in many ways because of the fact, that the U.S. government was supporting that slaughter. So meanwhile, the U.S. is, quote, and I'm citing again the report from FAIR, selling many billions of dollars of weapons to Saudi Arabia, refueling Saudi warplanes as they relentlessly bomb civilian areas, and providing intelligence and military assistance to the Saudi Air Force, unquote. So what was MSNBC covering when they weren't covering Yemen? They were fixated on Russia. And in fact, as FAIR pointed out, MSNBC ran almost 5,000% more segments that mentioned Russia than segments that mentioned Yemen. So you can't beat coverage of the official U.S. enemies. And this is the tried and true formula. And I have to say that a lot of the Cold War that now has pushed the world closer to nuclear apocalypse than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, a lot of that was fueled by MSNBC. It was a ratings winner, Rachel Maddow, for years and years and years, banged on the drum during the Trump presidency, claiming that the big threat to democracy in the United States was Russia, you know, pumping up Russiagate, something far, far out of proportion. And meanwhile, the genuine threats to democracy, the right wing extremists who are now assaulting the U.S. government, including from inside the majority of the House of Representatives, that whole realm got short shrift. So the idea of scapegoating a foreign enemy for the terrible deficits and perversions of purported democracy in the United States, this is very attractive. And I would say that when Hillary Clinton lost the election in 2016, there was immediately a fundamental choice, which was resolved within 24 hours, well documented. A day after Hillary Clinton lost the presidency in 2016, the decision was made by top campaign managers to blame Russia. Why would you blame her proximity to Wall Street? Why would you blame her willingness to align herself with major corporations at the expense of working people? Why would you blame her unpopular support and affinity for U.S. wars? that's not an attractive option to the power structure. The attractive option was to blame Russia. And that set a series of cascading events that transformed the Democratic Party more and more into a warlike propaganda party, which we're finding the results now of. So if you look at the present day of U.S. media coverage, you have tremendous support for unbridled weapon sales towards Ukraine without any call for genuine diplomacy or negotiations of any sort. So the militarism, what Martin Luther King Jr. called the madness of militarism, is alive and well and so dangerous in the United States, and we're not getting any access, meaningful access in the mass media to challenge it. That's why building alternative media from the grassroots, organizing among people who insist that democracy must come from the grassroots, is so essential. And the synergy between political organizing for progressive change and progressive media outlets, that synergy is absolutely crucial.
Why are Palestinian views on its conflict with Israel so underrepresented in the media?
Well, the combination of many factors has given the Israeli government a free pass. By any objective standards, I believe, Israel is an apartheid state. And we have many human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. They all have issued statements saying that Israel engages in apartheid. And yet the confluence of political power, of Israel support groups who are very strong on Capitol Hill, for so many reasons, it has been difficult to pull the mass media of the United States away from its obsequious support for Israel. It's really a tragedy. It has to change. It's very slowly changing. But after all, the occupation of Palestinian territories began in 1967. This has been going on for such a long time. The crimes against Palestinian people by the Israeli government have been systematic. And it's very notable that in recent months, as there have been protests by Israelis against the attacks by the Netanyahu regime, against the court system, that many are protesting, many are in the streets of Israel, and those protests have gotten a lot of support in the U.S. media. However, those protests on the whole do not address the oppression of Palestinian people. Those protests are basically saying, with few exceptions, we don't want the Israeli government to take away our freedom as Israeli Jews. And I think those protests are so circumscribed that a lot of U.S. mass media have been very supportive of those critiques of the Netanyahu government. What we need, again, is a single standard of human rights that insists that we want those human rights to be applied as a grid that is meaningful in a 360 direction. We're not going to pick and choose and cherry pick where human rights matter and where they don't. And the Israeli government gets a pass from the U.S. media. It's disgusting. It's outrageous. It should be opposed. The notion that criticizing Israel means anti-Semitism is absurd. I say that as an American Jew. I think it is just a time and place. This is so overdue to say, let's have a single standard of human rights. Let's have media coverage of Israel and its conduct that qualifies for journalism. So far, we really haven't gotten it.
Both Medea Benjamin and Noam Chomsky say attitudes toward Israel in the U.S. are changing, particularly among younger people. They are more critical. Do you find that to be the case?
There's no doubt that younger Americans, Jews and non-Jews alike, are much more critical of Israel. And that's a hopeful sign. There has been change at the grassroots of the United States and change in the media. But arguably, it's been glacial. It's certainly been way too slow. And I think we have an opportunity now to accelerate that change. It really means that we need to strip away like the layers of an onion, all the excuses that are given for turning away from the realities of Israel's conduct, which after all is a U.S. client state in many respects, an unprecedented 10-year grant of about $35 billion hotwired in, guaranteed by Congress several years ago. It's unprecedented, this kind of paying the piper for enforcing apartheid has been given as essentially a blank check, more than $3 billion a year from the U.S. government to Israel. One indication of the positive change is the example of Peter Beinart, someone who was very strongly supportive of Israel, who wrote a book called The Crisis of Zionism many years ago, which was, well, mildly critical, I would say, of Israel. And because he has opted to continue to scrutinize what Israel's actually done, he's become a very articulate, clear critic, not only of Israel, but of reflexive U.S. government support for Israel. And I think those kind of changes are happening, especially in the younger generation of the United States, the last couple of generations that have come to the fore. So there are reasons for hope, but also, I'm afraid, even more reasons for outrage and determination to change the status quo of U.S. support for Israel.
What is to be done? What practical steps would you recommend?
I believe in organizing as the key element to turn around these dire circumstances that we face: corporate power, class war waged from the top down, militarization of our society, and foreign policy. That means a shift in mindset to see that we're not consuming history off the shelf like some Wonder Bread, that we're going to create it, but that won't be done for us in any realm that we care about. As the saying goes, whatever your first major concern is, your second should be media. We need to build media organizations and support the ones that are doing progressive work, support them financially, support them in terms of spreading the word, and also learning more about how to, and actually implementing how to, organize with people we know and don't know. And I think that's pretty antithetical to the media training, because really, when you think about it, the main messages from, say, television involve go out and buy things and maybe vote once in a while. Well, we do need to go out and buy things. We certainly should vote. But the real changes are going to come when we find ways to work together for political power. And I believe that's inside and outside the electoral arena. When you look at the corruption of the Federal Communications Commission, for instance, that's not going to change until different people are in office. And we're not going to get different people in office until we elect them and we make sure we can overcome the big power of money. But there's also the real history that needs to be reignited more and more of social movements, where everything we have to be proud of in this country was a result of people organizing from the bottom up, generating the power of social movements. That's really where our best future is.
You conclude War Made Invisible with a quote from James Baldwin. I'm going to ask you to read it.
Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
Thanks very much for your time.
Oh, thank you, David. And I'm just, for decades now, a big admirer of alternative radio, and thank goodness for what you're doing.
Thanks, Norman. You were just listening to Norman Solomon, War Crimes and War Criminals. I talked with him on May 10th. Norman Solomon, a distinguished political commentator and media critic, is the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Medea Benjamin, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. www.normansolomon.org. For copies of today's program, Norman Solomon, War Crimes and War Criminals, and for his book, War Made Invisible, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Harry Belafonte, Island in the Sun.
This is my island in the sun. Here my people have toil since time begun. I may sail on many a sea. The shores will always be home to me. Oh, island in the sun. Of your forest, waters, your shining sands. Oh, island in the sun, built to me by my father's hand. All my days I will sing in praise of your forest, waters, your shining sands. Step to me, I heard enough from your mouth.